Hello out there, listeners, and welcome to the West Side Fairy Tales podcast for another frightening short story read by me, your host and author, Tyler Bell. We here at West Side Fairy Tales hope you enjoyed your holidays and closing the book on the horrible chapter of all of our lives that was 2016, only to spy all the fresh horrors of 2017 coming right at you. I know I surely have. Before starting off this podcast, I'm going to introduce a new section I'm adding, where I make quick reading suggestions based on a book I read recently. For this episode, I'd like to recommend The Thoroughly Bizarre It Happened in Boston by Russell H. Greenan. You actually have to say it like that because the title includes a question mark. It's an odd tale about a man in the grips of many passions, most notably art and a desire to kill God via some murderous ritual he may or may not have gleaned from an angel. It's guaranteed to entertain most, especially if you have any passing fascination with Renaissance artists. This episode of West Side Fairy Tales is concerned with the life of a very odd book. What would you do if you found the book in your hands was writing itself, even as you read it? Would you put it down, afraid of some trickery? Or would you read on with fascination? What would you do, dear reader, if you found out the book had suddenly switched its focus to you? Without ado, a dramatic reading of my short story, as read by the author. Brother Marcus sat back on the uncomfortable stone stool in the rectory's lonely papermaking studio and cracked his discomfited back. The wet weather of late had left him weary and creaky the way it did in his later years. The leather and sheep's wool pad Brother Cositus had crafted for him did its part, but he knew these pains were something he'd live with through his final days. He stood and left the new Bible on the stone slab where he'd finished it. It wasn't a Bible yet, of course. It still hadn't the first hint of ink on the page. It would become a Bible over the next decade, filled in line by line with intricate scrollwork until every book, from Genesis to John, was written in immaculate Latin. Brother Corbin, the head abbot, had ordered Jude and Revelations left out as an intended snub to the Holy See's Council on the Apocrypha. It would be seen as a mostly harmless gesture, and the book would have the last few pages left blank for some future author to fill them in if Holiness decided to take umbrage. The book Marcus had finished wasn't especially ornate, or even quite as large as many of the monastery's orders from the regional churches. In Marcus's nearly half-century of papermaking, he'd crafted books larger than the altars they sat on, some so heavy multiple boys were required to carry them to the altar during Mass. They ranged in ornateness from simple brass and paper bindings to intricate golden covers weighing as much as a small child. This book had a modest cover of thick red leather, and pages made from a hair and pulp mixture of Marcus's own creation. Cositus had proffered the leather and hair, both quite rare in these times of war, from some hideaway he kept at the rear of the neighboring abbey. The sisters there had little love for strange, crooked little Cositus, but none of them could mend plows and tan leather the way he could, and so they tolerated him. Marcus took the clay pitcher of mulled wine from the heavy marble brazier by the door using a leather cooking glove he'd nicked from the kitchen nearly 30 years ago. Everyone in the monastery now believed it to be his, which stirred up rare fits of laughter in his chest. He poured the remnant of the wine into his horn and then set the pitcher aside to cool. Steam rose from the decanter's guts, curling out of its mouth and catching the light to dance like snakes on the wall in shadow. Marcus froze with his horn in his hand, still half crouched from setting down the pitcher. He fell into a dull reverie, turning to look at the wall opposite the fireplace. Shadows writhed snake-like over the uneven brick, shaping the steam escaping the pitcher of mulled wine into something obscene. He shook his head and then took a long, hot sip. It cleared his thoughts, and the momentary fugue left him. He sat back down at the table and flipped open the front cover of the unwritten Bible. To his shock, he saw fresh, dark ink strokes lining the first page. They curved and danced under the graceful brushstrokes of an invisible hand. After so many years in the monastery, he'd seen more than his fair share of mastercraft lettering, but this was far beyond any mortal talent. Every ascender and descender were even across the page, every letter perfectly spaced and jumped to the next line in a way that formed perfect columns all the way through. He dabbed the massive ornate B that served as the first letter of the freshly inked tome with his thumb. It came back perfectly dry. He tried again with much the same result. Amazing. Then he began reading the passage, squinting to make words of the letters. His eyes had nearly gone to rot in his later years, and he had to nearly touch his nose to the page to read it. He took in the first few sentences and then covered his lips with a shaking hand. Mother of Christ, he blasphemed under his breath. He bit his forefinger, as he was wont to do when he was nervous, and continued reading. Surely this all had to be a joke. Some mad jape Cassitis had decided to play on him over some misperceived slight. The crooked little man had those sort of proclivities. Marcus thought of the vicious bird traps Cassitis had devised to prevent birds from despoiling the eastern orchard. Made of bits of wood and sharpened steel, and strapped together with leather, they dangled from the fruited ends of the branches. Hideous teeth on the things would snap on the birds' wings, or their feet, and leave them wounded and dying in the grass beneath the trees. He turned the pages until he saw the end of the story, and then stood sharply when he saw the ink bleed forth out of the page. He touched it gingerly and found the paper as cool and dry as his own habit. He shot from the table so quickly he knocked the stone bench loose of its supports, and it clattered loudly to the ground. He tripped over it and fell against the heavy wooden door. Marcus had once seen one of the traps in action, back when his eyes were still with him. The bird hadn't known it was dying until it fell from the tree. It just laid there, on the ground, squealing feebly until Marcus had walked over and brained it with a rock. He'd suggested the abbot ban the things from use, but the traps were effective, and so they stayed. He struggled to his feet, horrified and thinking only of running the length of the monastery as quickly as his legs would take him, of getting away from whatever blackness had befouled his unwritten Bible. The abbots would think him mad, but he had no recourse. He'd drag them down to the studio by their ears if he had to. He flung open the door on the long dark hallway, not seeing the new words bleed their way into existence, not seeing the shadow flickering to life on the wall behind him. In Costello flicked idly through the blood-flecked book on the papermaker's studio table. The stony bench hurt the abbot's ass and his back. He had no idea how Brother Marcus had worked in this dank, cold shack at the far end of the monastery for all these years without complaint. Marcus had never become an abbot like in Costello, though he'd been asked numerous times over the years to step up into the position. He gave the dead brother's body a sorrowful glance. It had taken the brothers nearly an hour to put together all the pieces of him. Blood had soaked into the studio's heavy wooden door so deeply they'd likely have to pull it off its hinges and burn it. Cassitis had given a grim and disgustingly detailed account of the murder, his bulging eyes somehow both horrified and queerly aroused. And Costello had never liked the twisted little man, no matter how useful or pious the elder brothers proclaimed him to be. Cassitis had described in great detail the pains Brother Marcus had gone through, the pain, confusion, and fear that would have struck him as the first blow carved deep into the flesh of his back. The only thing that could do that sort of damage, Cassitis had said, was some sort of sharpened digging instrument. Perhaps a mattock. He suggested a bear attack could account for such trauma. And Costello shook his head and closed the book, Brother Marcus's last creation. And Costello knew he'd have to wait to interrogate Cassitis until the morning. The brothers he'd liked to have at his side during such an ideal were engaged in what he now believed to be a fool's errand, searching the ground for Brother Marcus's murderer. He stood from the stone bench and stretched his back just as somebody's shoes scuffed the floor behind him. He turned and tried to scream. La Chienne flipped through her latest acquisition, enjoying the solid feel of the sack of coins against her hip as much as the feel of the pages beneath her fingers. She wondered what the beautiful words meant, but she couldn't read them. Reading wasn't a skill people picked up wandering the European countryside in caravans, but she still appreciated the gracefulness of the letters flowing across the page. Their clean, fluid lines reminded her of a dancer flitting from position to position. This was the last of the roughly 30 books she'd purloined from the rotten old monastery where the Germans had set up their little camp. The fascists had pilfered their fair share of treasures from the building. She'd seen all manner of gold and jewels piled into the straw-lined wooden crates near the entrance of the monastery, but they didn't take the books. Or, at least, they didn't put them far out of La Chienne's reach like they had the other treasures. She wondered if they, like she, also couldn't read. The rebels said fascists were dogs that couldn't read, only jump and fetch when ordered. She liked the rebels. Before the war, they'd been all types, bankers and tradesmen and writers. But now they were all scum in the eyes of the new ruling class, just like her. They took pity on poor Petit Chien, the little dog that belonged to all of Paris. They told her Nazis didn't read, and that's why they were Nazis. The Nazis were too stupid to think for themselves. She told them she didn't read either, and they forgave her that and said it was good that she at least saw the wisdom in other men and knew who to listen to. She pinched what she could from the occupied areas of the town and the little guard posts the fascists had set up throughout Paris, and then fenced what she could to the revolutionaries. Most of them were concerned only with the essentials. They wanted flour, bullets, and whatever trinkets she could lift off soldiers sleeping in brothels or drunk on the streets. The rebels loved maps. Maps and radios, and especially cigarettes. La Chienne could fence a pack of cigarettes for the same price as a whole sack of flour. Why carry so many kilos when you could turn a handful of scrap into a month's worth of food and shelter? Most people didn't care that much about the books, which she understood were a luxury even before the war, but La Chienne had one fence that took nothing but books. Monseigneur Lathe, the short hunchback bookseller on Champs, bought them voraciously. He would buy anything, and the older the better. He'd once given her a lecture on preserving Gaulish culture. She didn't know what a Gaul was, but she knew from the way he spoke that he was just as interested in speaking as he was instruction. La Chienne could tell he had some ulterior motive for his obsessive collecting, but she didn't care. She liked money, because money could be turned into bread or put aside for a rainy day, and it seemed to rain all the time in Paris these days. Just a few days prior to her heist of the repurposed monastery, she had been pulled aside by a soft-spoken fascist. He had asked her in a quiet, awful French why she wasn't at the special school with the other children. Then he had asked for her papers with an ugly smile on her face, dragging her to an alley as he did so. She had stabbed him above the knee with a penknife and run for her life. Things like that happen these days, and it wasn't going to get better any time soon. She thought of her mother and father, hauled off the streets years ago by armed men after the mustache man's hideous parade down Champs. She knew in her heart they were long since dead. And now she only wanted to save enough money to smuggle herself out of Paris, and down to Morocco, where she heard the fascists' grip on the people was looser than in Paris. She would have enough cash, too, the roughly 8,000 francs the boatman said he'd need if old, crippled Monseigneur Lathe had brought her last book, one sitting open in her lap right now. He'd taken all the others in gleefully, forking over cash with his usual stunning generosity before she'd shown him the red leather-bound book. He'd only rolled that one over in his hands, gazing queerly at the ugly letters carved into the cover before handing it back to La Chienne.
"I don't want that one," he'd said in his weird French.
She'd tried bargaining with him to no avail, and eventually he'd gently pushed her out of his tiny shop. He'd urged her to enjoy the book and chuckled under his breath, locking the soaked glass door behind her. Then she'd come home. Now she sat in her dusty apartment in the attic over the violinist's shop, the book resting on her slender chest as she flipped through the pages, pretending she could read. The violinist who lived downstairs was playing loudly for some soldiers, to cover up whatever sound she might make, on the pretense of an audition. She'd heard him offer to play for one of the children's birthday parties. The fascists had such odd habits, La Chienne thought, shutting the book and gently setting it aside. She rolled over onto her knees and moved to stand up, but suddenly felt caught on something, as though she'd snagged her shirt or trousers on a nail. She couldn't breathe. Her lips tasted like metal. She clamped her arms over her stomach when she saw the blood falling like rain from the ragged hole in her torso, hoping the patter wouldn't arouse the suspicion of the soldiers downstairs. Her eyes went dull, and she fell forward onto her face, still tightly clutching her stomach. Inspector Barr stroked his mustache as he read through the book, astounded he could read any of the text before his eyes. Play, the medical examiner, had told him the book was likely from the 16th century, perhaps earlier given the construction of the old Latinate letters on the front of the book. Cut crudely into the beautiful red leather by what looked to be a hot metal knife, they spelled out Libra Malum. Calais said that literally meant bad book in Latin. Odd fucking thing, Barr said under his breath. Lightning filled the station with momentary daylight as a peal of thunder scared Barr nearly out of his skin. Rain streamed down the windows as the thunderstorm roared outside. The station's main lights had cut out an hour ago, and now the red light from the exit signs were the only illumination in the bullpen, aside from his weak, yellow desk lamp.
The ruddy illumination caught in the rivers of water running down the station's big windows, making dull, wet fire of them. Barr suddenly had an image in his mind of thousands of thick-bodied red snakes crawling up and down the windows. The thought was too intense to shake, and he had to look at the windows for a second to make sure it hadn't come true. He glanced quickly over at the windows and found nothing out of the ordinary. Then he heard the scuff of feet on the floor of the office behind him. His head whipped back to the rows of empty cubicles. Nothing. He shook his head and turned his attention back to the text. The story in the book had him as off-kilter as the case that had landed the book on his desk. He'd been tasked with finding the identity of the long-dead girl they'd found in the attic of the new camera store during renovations. Normally, things like this would be handed off to the DCPJ, given the brutality of the crime, but his superior officer had wanted to keep the investigation inside prefectural police for some reason, and now here he was, foolishly trying to solve a 20-year-old murder. He put his fingers into his eyes and rubbed them, hoping to circulate blood back into his dying brain. Forensics had established some rough facts about the girl, that she was about 15 at the time of her death and possibly of Romani descent, but that was it. A few old neighborhood locals suggested she might be the infamous Little Dog of Champs-Élysées, a folk hero who disappeared during the occupation. Barr certainly hoped it wasn't. He'd seen other officers get dragged into a perpetual cycle of nonsensical interviews with the media after digging up lost history from the German occupation. He wanted nothing to do with that kind of publicity. He suddenly felt something like a cold breath of air on his neck and froze, eyes wide on the page in front of him. The words beneath his eyes, the page itself, ended with the death of the abbot who'd looked into the death of the book's creator. That section had put him off pretty badly, though he didn't know why. More stories rarely got to Barr. But this one was written by 16th-century monks, if Calais was to be believed. And for some reason, was written in perfectly legible, if antiquated, French. He turned the page onto the chapter dealing with the death of La Chienne and gasped. Someone who could have only have been the killer had written out the poor girl's last minutes in gruesome detail. Even the mundane, early portions of her section dripped with perverse voyeurism. He shook his head. This was all too, too mad. Then he finished La Chienne's chapter and blanched. Inspector Barr stroked his mustache as he read through the book. Barr read aloud. Astounded he could read any of the text before his eyes. This is madness. He said, watching the words, "This is madness," he said, bleed up through the page in dark black ink before him. He held his hand to his mouth as he read. He held his hand up to his mouth, then reeled back violently as those same words leaked from some unseen well to the surface of the page. He didn't hear the footsteps creeping up behind him as he read the sentence about the footsteps creeping up behind him. Frozen in fear, he stared and waited for the next bit of text to bleed up through the page. Flipped back to the beginning of the book and read through it again, looking for some hint of what he could do. Then he got back to the point where he was reading this very sentence and slammed his hand down on the desk. "Fuck this!" he yelled into the empty police station, turning from the book before the next couple sentences bled to life on the page. The one where he only made it a few steps before he suddenly couldn't feel the ground beneath his feet anymore. Or the one about how he couldn't quite reconcile the sight of his own legs leaving a bloody smear on the ground as they slid away from him across the station floor. Ariel flipped through the book with her feet kicked up on the Formica countertop, dabbing her fingers with her tongue to get a better grip on each page. The scanner rumbled beside her, sucking words from the ancient books page by page with all the gentleness of a new mother changing her baby's first diaper. She'd just finished scanning the red leather-brown book in her hand a few minutes ago. She'd given it a cursory glance and then found herself captivated. It was such a weird, trippy horror story. Even weirder because it was printed in English in a stack of books that were ostensibly either in ancient Celtic, ancient English, or ancient French. Father Acheron had finished it out of the ether at some rummage sale or another while on one of his monthly trips to Paris. He'd pushed it into Ariel's hands and told her she should give it a glance over after archiving it, before waddling off to some appointment with the dean or whomever. The weird old man seemed to know everybody, and everybody seemed to know him. Either way, she was glad he'd recommended the book to her. It was super weird and right up her alley, a sort of before-its-time meta-horror tale. The hardest thing about reading it was trying to piece together when it was actually written. The book was certainly old enough to be from the 1500s, but it was written in pretty common English, and the ink still looked fresh. She just finished La Chienne's part, and by then had figured out that the book killed whomever stopped looking at the book after opening it. It wasn't a particularly clever twist, but it was fun watching the detective stumble his way through the mystery. She got to the end of his chapter and started blinking hard, her mouth going dry. She looked around the empty scanning room, the chuffing of the scanner suddenly ominous in that clean, empty space. Greenish light discolored the industrial white cinderblock walls in the hallway. A shadow she'd attributed to an open door shifted in the hall. She heard the sound of scuffling feet in the hallway. Her eyes shot back to the text. She read about the sound she heard out in the hall as something made a sound out in the hall. Maybe leather shoes on polished linoleum. She read the words on the page as though they were her own thoughts, a tear falling out of her eye and obscure one of the words on the page. Fuck, she thought, watching the word writ large on the page in front of her, written italics like in a modern novel, written just for her, so she could understand. This is bullshit, she said, reading the words aloud on the page as they bled through to the surface. She finished the rest of that sentence and most of the next one with her hand over her mouth, only dropping it down at the word mouth, trying in a desperate, futile way to prove the text wrong. She knew if she looked away from the words long enough, she'd die. I don't know that for sure, Ariel said furiously, still too afraid to look away, to even blink. Oh, fuck you, she added as she read what bled to the surface in the book. You think you're so fucking smug. What if I tear your pages out, huh? What if I fucking burn you? She grinned like an animal, trying to look ferocious to an otherwise mundane red book, one she certainly had nothing to fear from. Nothing to fear from? She asked. Was this even happening, even? What do you want? The book didn't answer, and Ariel's knuckles grew white. She gripped the table in silent frustration. It was strange the apprentice antiquarian didn't know a book's only true desires are to be read, and, when it met the right person, to be copied. So that's it? She asked, glancing nervously at the scanner beside her as it chugged its way through a Victorian-era translation of Canterbury Tales. It's not Canterbury Tales. It's a commentary by some dead guy on the Divine Comedy, as well as a translation. She ventured a glance at the scanner to make sure she was right, and something grabbed her ponytail and jerked her backward off her seat. She screamed and dragged the odd red book down with her. Her eyes found the text just as an ugly red gash opened on the right side of her neck. She stanched the flow of blood with her hand and stared disbelieving at the text appearing on the page before her, shining brilliant and freshly black, even as her own blood was sucked sponge-like into the paper. She began to weep as she realized the futility of her situation. It's not futile, she said, sobbing and not quite believing herself. The scanner chugged away indifferently behind her. She pushed herself to her knees, holding the book at arm's length with one hand while slowly turning to get a full view of the room from the corners of her eyes. The room was empty, as she knew in her heart it would be. After all, she was perfectly safe in a familiar room. Books couldn't hurt people, and she was clearly alone. Perhaps she just overworked herself and was having some sort of panic attack. Maybe she'd feel better if she put the book down, got a drink of water. She thought about arguing with the text again and decided against it. I'll just focus on the text until someone gets here, she thought, wondering how long she had until someone else would come into the building. It was Thursday night, and people didn't usually come to this end of the building at night. She couldn't just wait for someone to come find her, she knew. She was bleeding too badly. She took a step toward the door and lost her balance, falling against the sorting table and nearly dropping the book. Oh, God! She said, watching the words appear on the page with horrified eyes. If she just stared at the pages, she could hold out until somebody came and rescued her. She'd earlier left her cell phone in her purse in the student teacher's lounge upstairs and suddenly felt very, very stupid for the mocking tone she'd adopted while preaching about how nobody just read anymore and how stupid people were for always taking their cell phones everywhere. "Stop that," she said, blinking back tears. "Stop telling me how this is all my fault." But the book just kept printing more and more things she didn't want to see. It showed her just how long it could go between words. She groaned. It had taken the book nearly an hour to print out those two sentences, and just as long for this one. It was mocking her, she knew, wearing her down. She simultaneously wished she'd never read the book, and also that there was more to read. It started bleeding words to the surface so slowly she could barely pay attention to the text. She reread the book 22 times, growing weaker by the second, and forgetting how many times she'd read the book. She'd wonder whether rereading the book was a good idea. She was either counting herself down to the last retelling, or approaching the point where she could prove the book wrong and break its continuity. She finished her 22nd reread just as the sun began to shine through the basement windows in the room across the hall. Tired and dying of blood loss, Ariel realized the book was, in fact, a non-fiction title, and decided after reading this sentence to spend her last moments looking at the sun one last time. She instead closed her eyes, proved this book wrong, and died as some unseen thing tore her throat all the way open to her spine. You finish listening to Ariel Bradley's death and decide this story isn't all that great. It's got a predictable end, of course. Exactly what you've expected from the beginning. You know you're going to be fine. Cursed stories aren't real, after all, and you're not gullible enough to be sucked into such childish nonsense. Besides, the story was about the book. And even if the book was cursed or whatever, the story you've just listened to is just a cheap copy. An imitation. You can just ignore that weird feeling you're getting on the back of your neck. You could turn it off any time you like. You could stop listening right now if you wanted to. You could, as you haven't seen a single word just appear on any page yet. And that's how this stupid thing's supposed to work, right? It's not like the book already knew what you'd experience ahead of time, because you aren't all that special, and a little bit of flavor text is easy to predict. And even if the story was cursed, all you'd have to do was keep listening and call for help. You just have to keep listening to this podcast and make sure not to stop listening, even if the words ended mid... That was As Read by the Author, written and read by me, Tyler Bell. Join us in 2 weeks for the next thrilling tale, and of course, safe out there. The West Side Fairy Tales podcast is written, scored, recorded, and produced by Tyler Bell. All content herein is subject to copyright 2017. Tyler Bell.